Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, James Bosick here with the American Brand Radio Initiative. This is a kind of a test Saturday night show. See, what happened if you were listening last Thursday? Thank you, by the way, for listening. I made a mistake when I was creating the show. And the bottom, you know, the long story short, the show was supposed to be created. When you do it, instead of going to the how many minutes you want your show on for, buddy, slot, I didn't put in 120 minutes. It's a 2-hour thing on Thursday nights. We have the American Brand Radio Initiative live at 7 over at the Patriot Nation Radio Network here on Blog Talk. And then from 8 to 9, our buddy Mark Hoffman, the man behind Patriot Nation Radio Network and Patriot Nation Radio Live, he comes on. But instead of doing it in 260-minute parcels, we just do it in one big 120-minute chunk. I go on at 7 and say my goodbyes around 8. Mark takes it from there to the top of the hour at 9. Well, I didn't do it right. And kind of screwed up the first half hour. It's kind of burned up, really, the first half hour of the radio initiative. But I was able to get everything recreated, and folks were ready to get the simulcast up, because we do a simulcast on Thursday nights with NWF News Without Filters, a Stidham Communications group. Well, Melissa worked on that. She got it fired up, saved that. I was able to get the show created, but my conscience was killing me because it was looking like it was going to be a really good show. So I decided to go ahead and do it tonight, just to test a couple of different things, see if we can get any listenership generated. It's going to be tough to tell with just one show, but just to see, I did a little promotion, and we'll see what's going on. Nothing special tonight. We're going to talk about a couple of things, though, kind of light. One of them is going to address the comments that President Trump made this week about bringing in too many people from these third world poop hole countries. He said something else, but I try to work clean, so we're gonna go with poop hole. And we have an inspector general inside the Washington bureaucracy that is in a position, I think, to save the country. And we'll be talking about all those things. First thing, though, I'll share with you is, women, let me find it. I drag this out periodically, and it was my intention to use it on Thursday when I started the show. But, I already told you about that. So, to make up for it, here it is. And I bring this out periodically because I think it bears repeating, and people need to be reminded of it, and listeners, you know, you never know. You might have some new people. You might have some old people that missed it. It's just good to go over it again. It was written by Dr. Ed Follner at the Heritage Organization, and it was written back in August of 2012. So it's been around a while, and I've used it considerably. It's about a 10-minute thing, and I want to share it with you, and it's called What is the Role of the People Here in the Republic, the United States? 62 million people, as we've said many times, voted for President Donald Trump. They didn't vote for the Republican Party. They didn't vote for John McCain or Chuck Grassley or Lindsey Graham. They didn't vote for those people. They voted for Donald Trump and his vision for the course correction that this country so desperately needs. That's part of it. But there is more involved to being a citizen, a true citizen of the United States. And it's from the stirring opening words of the Constitution that proclaim it to be the work of we, the people. In the Declaration of Independence, the American people had announced to the world that they were sovereign and free. In the Constitution, they sought to defend this freedom by creating a unique government for an exceptional nation, a government that derived its just powers from the consent of its people. So in this American Republic, what is the role of the people? The United States is exceptional because of its universal founding principles. At the heart of these principles is the belief that people are free by nature and possess inherent rights. The use each of us makes of these rights will naturally be different, and the outcomes of those choices will naturally differ too. But the choice remains our own. Freedom is thus inextricably bound up with living our lives as we see fit. This is self-government in the truest sense of the term. We the people need not slavishly defer to experts. We can be trusted to govern ourselves. That is why government must remain limited. The people have given it only limited powers, as described in the Constitution. When government takes more than we've given it, it renders our choices meaningless. At worst, unlimited government is tyrannical. At best, it imposes a dull uniformity that crushes true diversity and saps the independent spirit of the people. The founders believed that a crucial problem was to avoid creating a government that could be dominated by a single faction. That faction might be a minority, it might even be a majority, but no matter its size, it would inevitably seek to promote its own narrow self-interests at the expense of the liberties of the people. One purpose of the Constitution's checks and balances, one reason why it divides and limits power, is to restrain the ambition of the powerful and, in the words of the Constitution, to ensure that government genuinely promotes the general welfare. As the federal government has grown over the past 100 years, the business of government has increasingly become taking from Paul to benefit Peter and then borrowing from Peter to pay off Paul. What the supporters of big government call the general welfare is merely the artful distribution of favors to particular factions. The federal government is not supposed to be the most important institution in America. In securing the general welfare, it is supposed to do only those things that are provided for in the Constitution. It must, for example, provide for the common defense and regulate our relations with foreign nations. It must respect our right to enjoy the fruits of our labor by taxing lightly and defend the freedom of the marketplace by ensuring the rule of law. And it must remember that the family and religion are where we learn virtue, and that without virtue, government cannot be both limited and free. As John Adams stated, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. In the United States, government requires not merely the consent of the governed. It rests ultimately upon the ability of the people to govern themselves. So the first role, the first duty of the people is to ensure that they remain virtuous and free. That's why the American system is based on the rights of the individual, but not on individualism. When Thomas Jefferson wrote in his notes on the state of Virginia that it is the manners and spirit of a people which preserve a republic in its vigor, he captured a vital truth about American freedom. The founders placed great hopes in the Constitution, but they knew no paper constraints could preserve liberty. That duty rested ultimately with the American people. The role of the Constitution was to restrain and to check and, as Washington wrote, to raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair. In the words of the Declaration, the lives of our founders and the design of the Constitution, those things can inspire, but on their own, they cannot preserve the American Republic. Only the American people, steeped in the principles that inspired the founders and animated the Declaration, can do that. And America's virtues don't appear out of thin air. They're not the result of individuals living in isolation. They are social virtues. They're nurtured in families. They're sustained in religious congregations. And they're fostered in the everyday interaction of work, hobbies, and life. Long before the Declaration, foreign observers in this country were surprised by the number and vigor of America's social institutions and by the everyday democracy of American marriage, work, and society. Far more than any other nation in the world, Americans recognized each other as social and thus as political equals. That's why the traditional American virtue of self-reliance is so vital and why the growth of government is so dangerous. Self-reliance means we have an obligation to try not to impose financially on our equals. Big government does not see citizens who provide for themselves and help their fellows. Big government sees subjects whom it must tax and on whom it must spend. The wish of the founders was not for us to live as isolated individuals, nor was it to insulate government from religion and civil society. On the contrary, it was to insulate religion and civil society from the government, to prevent government from weakening and corrupting it. The founders believed that if the sources of civic virtue remained free and strong, the American people would remain capable of self-government. There's no magic in the American people that can save them if they do not wish to save themselves. That's why Ronald Reagan said in his famous speech on the evil empire of the Soviet Union that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. As Americans, we have always an obligation to pass the inheritance of freedom on, unimpaired, to the next generation. That is the second duty of the people. Today, everyone says they're in favor of civil society, but not everyone really understands what that means. When the left speaks of civil society, it often implies that it sees civil society as the government's agent, paid by the government to do the work that government has not yet taken over. In the realm of diplomacy, civil society is a code word for self-nominated left-wing groups that claim to speak for the people of the world and assert a moral authority greater than democratically elected governments. Abroad, the United States needs to stand up for the legitimacy of sovereign democracies, which are the only governments that allow genuine civil society to flourish. At home, Americans should not be taken in by the argument that civil society needs to be directed by the state in order to do good works. That's just another subterfuge that weakens civil society. It conceals the hand of big government, and ultimately it impoverishes all of us, both spiritually and financially. This subterfuge rests on the deep contempt that the left has entertained for civil society since the 1960s, when it came to the conclusion that the job of the government was to liberate us from our oppressive private lives. Churches, charities, or institutions like the Heritage Foundation are part of civil society, and all of them can do good work. But our bowling leagues, our scout troops, our farm stands are equally part of civil society. Just because an institution is social does not mean that it's everyone's business. On the contrary, the power of civil society stems from the fact that so much of it is personal, not intended to remedy any broader problem. Government must be built on respect for the virtues that civil society fosters, or it will ultimately destroy civil society. The lesson of history from Europe is that as their governments have expanded, their charities, churches, and their social institutions have withered. The United States is an island of stability in a world of turmoil. We have the same constitution today that we had over 200 years ago. Our concern to protect America from its enemies abroad and to promote American leadership in the world must never cause us to forget that our power to lead flows from our unique combination of a powerful but limited government with a dynamic and self-reliant society. When we see others abroad who share that vision and who are struggling against tyranny, we should give them our friendship. When we see a tyranny fall, we should applaud cautiously, knowing that democracy is created from the bottom up, not the top down. Our role in the world flows from what makes us exceptional, to defend and promote the universal principles upon which the American people founded their government. That's why the true role of the American people is to ensure that both they and their government stay faithful to those principles. This is partly a job for the free press and the ballot box, but we will not be able to speak and vote in support of America's founding principles if we forget what those principles are. In his great farewell address from the Oval Office on January 11, 1989, Ronald Reagan called on a nation to foster informed patriotism. Reagan believed that after the end of the Cold War, the patriotism spirit was in the air, but he thought that wasn't good enough. For Reagan, patriotism had to be well-grounded in popular culture and to recognize always that America is freedom, and freedom is special and rare. American freedom began with the American memory. And if that was not preserved, Reagan warned, the ultimate result would be the erosion of the American spirit. And Reagan was right. We must understand our Constitution if we are to defend what we have achieved under it. And we must know our history if we are to value the ordered liberty the founders bequeathed to us. We must be free by governing ourselves, preserve our freedom for the next generation, and stand for freedom at home and abroad. We, the people, created this republic, and we, the people, must preserve it. That once again, Dr. Edwin Follner from the Heritage Foundation. And you can find a lot of great stuff at the Heritage Foundation. In terms of a group of individuals who do an excellent and very clear and concise job of helping others understand the Constitution, the Heritage Foundation is the place to go. It's And they have a number of different avenues of thought from a conservative perspective. Hey, conservative perspective, that's me. Anyway, that's I just wanted to share that with you. These are the things that we have to do as Americans, as good citizens. I remember as a boy when I was matriculating at Lincoln Elementary School. The upper kids, the upper grades, the sixth graders, I think, maybe it was just the sixth graders, had a civics class. And in that civics class, they were taught how to be good citizens. And they were taught a lot about the construction of American federal government and state and local government, the division of powers, and the checks and balances that were applied to these three separate entities, the judicial, the executive, and the legislative bodies, to prevent one from overwhelming the other two, or two overwhelming the other one. And I blame the school system for this because I believe, having been in the school system myself for a number of years, it would be a good and true thing for them to resurrect the civics program, the civics education program, and I think that they should go immediately into the elementary schools. They should start at about the fourth or fifth grade, and civics should be something that the children have, if not every year, then every other year. Okay, I guess I've preached enough about that. Let's go ahead and lighten things up a little bit. This was another thing. Again, these are some things that I wanted to share with you last Thursday night before I screwed the moose. and anyway, just to lighten things up a little bit, what I would like to share with you now, speaking of school and my time in the school business, I have in front of me the 56 worst analogies from high school papers. And if you're a little fuzzy on what an analogy is, don't worry about it. As soon as I start reading them, you're gonna understand what I do. And bear with me. I am going All this talking makes a man thirsty. What I'm going to try and do is with as much of a straight face as I can, because even though I've read these things, you know, a dozen times probably, if not more, some, they're pretty funny. Some, not all of them, and we may not go through all of them, but I just want to share these with you. Number one, and away we go. Her eyes were like two brown circles with big black dots in the center. He was as tall as a 6'3" tree. Her face was a perfect oval, like a circle that had its two sides gently compressed by a thigh master. From the attic came an unearthly howl. The whole scene had an eerie, surreal quality, like when you're on vacation in another city and Jeopardy comes on at 7 p.m. instead of 7:30. Number five, one of my favorites. John and Mary had never met. They were like two hummingbirds who had also never met. She had a deep, throaty, genuine laugh, like that sound a dog makes just before he throws up. The ballerina rose gracefully on point and extended one slender leg behind her like a dog at a fire hydrant. Number eight, he was as lame as a duck. Not the metaphorical lame duck either, but a real duck that was actually lame, like maybe from stepping on a landmine or something. her vocabulary was as bad as, like, whatever. She grew on him like he was a colony of E. coli, and she was room temperature Canadian beef. The revelation that his marriage of 30 years had disintegrated because of his wife's infidelity came as a rude shock, like a surcharge at a formerly surcharge-free ATM. The lamp just sat there, like an inanimate object. Ah, this is another good one. McBride fell 12 stories, hitting the pavement like a hefty bag filled with vegetable soup. His thoughts tumbled in his head, making and breaking alliances like underpants in a dryer without cling free. That's right, 56 of these babies. He spoke with the wisdom that can only come from experience, like a guy who went blind because he looked at a solar eclipse without one of those boxes with a pinhole in it. And now he goes around the country speaking at high schools about the dangers of looking at a solar eclipse without one of those boxes with a pinhole in it. Long separated by cruel fate, the star-crossed lovers raced across the grassy field toward each other like two freight trains. One having left Cleveland at 6:36 p.m., traveling at 55 miles an hour. The other from Topeka at 4:19 p.m. at a speed of 35 miles an hour. Shots rang out, as shots are wont to do. The little boat drifted across the pond exactly the way a bowling ball wouldn't. Her hair glistened in the rain like a nose hair after a sneeze. You try reading these things with a straight face. The hailstones leaped from the pavement just like maggots when you fry them in hot grease. They lived in a typical suburban neighborhood with picket fences that resembled Nancy Kerrigan's teeth. He fell for her like his heart was a mob informant and she was the East River. Even in his last years, Grandpappy had a mind like a steel trap, only one that had been left out so long that it had rusted shut. He felt like he was being hunted down like a dog in a place that hunts dogs, I suppose. She was as easy as the TV guide crossword. She walked into my office like a centipede with 98 missing legs. The plan was simple, like my brother Bernie, but unlike Bernie, this plan just might work. The young firefighter had a hungry look, the kind you get from not eating in a while. Oh, Jason, take me, she panted, her breasts heaving like a college freshman on dollar beer night. Okay, we're down to the bottom of the hour. I'm only going to do a couple more of these, and we're going to go to break. It hurt the way your tongue hurts after you accidentally staple it to the wall. It was an American tradition, like fathers chasing kids around with power tools. Ah, I remember those days. The thunder was ominous sounding, much like the sound of a thin sheet of metal being shaken backstage during the storm scene of a play. She caught your eye like one of those pointy hook latches that used to dangle from screen doors and would fly up whenever you banged the door open again. He was as bald as one of the Three Stooges, either Curly or Larry, you know, the one that goes woo, 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 woo. Okay, I think I better stop there. We could go on. There were more. There were many, many more. But we're going to quit. We're going to take a little music break down here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back with more of the American Brand Radio Initiative Saturday Night Experiment in Terror. The studio didn't catch on fire, so I'm going to guess that this is fundamentally a positive. And I am looking and looking. And I'm still looking. Oh, I know exactly what I'm going to find now. That's it. Great. I just need to fast forward this thing. I think. Back after this. And we're back. The American Brand Radio Initiative. Nice to be here with you. Saturday night, kind of an experimental show. See what happens with it. And a penitence show, I guess. There's a lot of things going on that... little doggy trouble there. Everything's okay. What I was talking about was, gee whiz, I can't even remember what I was talking about. There's been a lot of talk about the Mueller investigation, Bob Mueller's independent counsel investigation of the alleged Russian collusion thing in the GPS fusion dossier. And there are some changes about a lot of things that have been happening, and a lot of people have been asking the question, and what's going on, basically, is the previous administration covered up for the sins of the Hillary Clinton campaign and Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Global Initiative and all those things. And now that those people who were in positions of power that enabled this cover-up are doing so, you know, they're out now, and other people have come in, things are changing. And the big question is, and the big question has always been when it concerns Hillary Clinton, that she, you know, is she ever going to go to jail? And a lot of people have said from the very beginning, she's never going to see the inside of a jail. We're just going to have to be content with her discredit and being convicted in the court of public opinion, which would have meant absolutely nothing to her because she has absolutely no shame whatsoever. However, I saw Dick Morris on a little blog he does, it came across in social media. And Dick Morris, as many of you will remember, was a longtime confidant of the Clintons and also a trusted political advisor, insider in the early days of the first Clinton term. Well, he says a lot of people have been asking him these very same questions as whether or not Hillary Clinton is going to be, will she ever go to jail? This is what he has to say about it. Dick Morris. It's about an 8-minute clip. Worth the listen.
Hi, how are you doing? You know, every day I get people who ask me, is Hillary headed to jail? Are her legal problems mounting to that point? And until yesterday or the day before, I basically said, well, who knows? She's done some bad things and maybe they'll catch up with her, maybe they won't. But now, for the first time, there is a serious possibility that she could be indicted and convicted, and even a possibility Bill Clinton could be, based on the pay-for-play scandal in the State Department. Just to back up a little bit, let's understand what happened. When Hillary became Secretary of State, she had this Clinton Foundation she ran with Bill, and somebody, I'll bet you it was her, came up with this brilliant idea that they would sell access to the Secretary of State in return for donations to the Clinton Foundation. We'll give you access, you give us money. And by access, they meant appointments with her to see her, or to have her travel to their country, or to preside at their job fair or at their economic meeting. And those are pretty important goodies to pass out. Sometimes they involved overt policy options, like when Russia tried to buy 25% of the uranium supply of the United States. And Hillary approved that, and there was an overt payment made to Bill of $500,000 for giving a speech in Moscow at the same time that Hillary approved the deal, a deal that was no way in the interests of the United States. And this pay-for-play really reached enormous proportions. It reminds me a little bit of 1800 when Napoleon was in charge and Talleyrand was his foreign minister. And the U.S. sent James Monroe over to negotiate with the French so they'd stop seizing our ships. And Talleyrand said, I won't meet with you until you pay me £1,000,000, £1,000,000. And Monroe said, what? And he said, yep, I need a personal bribe of $1,000,000 to talk to you. And Monroe went home, and the slogan became millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. And that's really what we're talking about now. She would say, you've got to give me $1,000,000 to my foundation to get an appointment to see me or to get Bill out to speak to your foundation. And This was all documented in a book by Peter Schweitzer called Clinton Cash. That was a number one bestseller for many, many weeks and months during the campaign, that did incredible research on seven or eight of these scandals. But it was seven or eight of hundreds. And because he didn't have subpoena power, he couldn't delve deeper than just what the superficial reports and circumstances would permit him to do. He had one instance in the Congo, several in Malaysia, the uranium deal, and a whole bunch of them, one in South America, around the world. And this became basically a Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, mom-and-pop industry. And the price for a meeting with Hillary was X, usually about $500,000, and the favors they distributed were enormous. Now, this was all during the Obama administration. And Hillary figured there's no way we're going to get investigated. Obama controls the U.S. attorneys. I'm going to get elected president after Obama. I'm not going to investigate myself, and this thing will just go on and we'll get away with it scot-free. Then something unusual happened. Donald Trump won the election. But before Trump won the election, enterprising and independent U.S. attorneys in four cities, New York, Little Rock, Miami, and Washington, all launched their own investigation of the pay-for-play scheme in the Clinton Foundation. But for a U.S. attorney to do an investigation, he needs subpoena power. Otherwise, he can't make people testify. And to get subpoena power, he needs a grand jury that approves the subpoena. And to get a grand jury, he needs the U.S. Attorney General in Washington to approve it. And Loretta Lynch said no to all four attorney generals, deputy attorneys. So there was no way they could pursue investigations. They started, but they couldn't come up with much. Now, the U.S. attorney for Little Rock, Arkansas, a Trump appointee, is reopening that investigation and really going into it with the grand jury, with subpoena power. And he has already started to interview witnesses. And it's very significant that it's in Little Rock, not in Washington. You see, one of the things the news media will never report is that when a guy like Mueller launches his investigation of Trump, it's always in D.C. In fact, it was in Northern Virginia, and they moved it to D.C. for only one reason. They want a Democratic grand jury loaded with Democrats, hopefully with minorities, that will approve anything they want to do that hurts Trump. And here it works the other way. You probably couldn't get them to vote a subpoena against Hillary, but you sure as hell can in Arkansas get them to do that. So this investigation now is proceeding, and, you know, they take time, they go through the evidence, but they construct it very firmly. And I think there is a very good chance that they will come up with evidence that could well lead to an indictment of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Now, Hillary's been there twice before. On two other occasions in her career, she has faced indictment, and both times she's managed to escape it very narrowly. The first one was when Bill and she fired everybody in the White House travel office because they wanted to put their own people in there, a patronage fight. And to dress it up, Hillary accused the head of the travel office, a guy named Billy Dale, of financial improprieties and ordered him fired. Dale sued. That turned out there were no improprieties, and Kenneth Starr, the special prosecutor, went to Hillary and said, "Did you order these firings?" And she said, "No, I did not." And he said, "I'm going to indict you for perjury." But then he looked at it, and Hillary's lawyer said, "How can you indict her for perjury? She didn't order those firings." And Starr said, "Sure she did." And he said, "Yes, she said it, but she wasn't in the chain of command. She was just the president's wife. She had no legal authority to order those firings, and therefore you can't indict her for saying she didn't." And on that basis, she skated. About 5 years later, she was in the hot seat again over a real estate deal in Arkansas that she called the Arkansas Industrial Development Committee. And it had another name that was used in common. And when Hillary was asked if she did the legal work on this deal that turned out to be fraudulent, She said no, meaning the AIDC, the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission, not the name of the other project, Castle Grande, which is how it was known. And because Starr never asked her about Castle Grande, but just about AIDC, she could say she was truthful in saying she didn't know anything about the project because he didn't call it by its right name. Believe it or not, those are the two ways she escaped jail. But this time it's going to be much, much more difficult because this time the evidentiary chain is deep. It's not just one comment. It's not just perjury. It's a whole pattern of bribery. It goes way back, goes very deep, goes into many other countries, and could be very significant. And there's one other element. In many of these countries, the local country is investigating them as well. And now that Hillary is not Secretary of State and won't be president, they may let those investigations go pretty deep. And that could be another source of information for the U.S. prosecutors. Now, as this situation matures, I'll be coming back on and giving you updates on this and other topics, and I appreciate you watching. Thanks very much. Have a nice day.
Dick Morris, ladies and gentlemen, kind of spotty there. I apologize for that. You know, when I logged on to do the show tonight, as soon as I got into the studio, Blog Talk came up with the thing that they were experiencing trouble. I don't know if it has to do with the weather or what's going on at the scene at the server. So if that sounded a little spotty, I apologize. So in essence, what Dick Morris is saying when he talks about this is that all this stuff that's going on in Washington is going on because it's a Democrat lynch party and Trump-hating crowd against the president. What's happening in Little is the thing that's going to be something that we need to look at. Also, I'm going to talk to you about a guy named Michael Horowitz. And these are the things that Dick Morris is talking about. Now, Michael Horowitz is from the Office of the Inspector General, and he is the Inspector General for the Department of Justice. Here's some things that are happening from an investigative standpoint involving Hillary Clinton, the foundation, and conduct by the Federal Bureau of Investigation's top brass during the 2016 election that was splashed all across the headlines. And here's what some of those things are. Number one, the Department of Justice is taking a fresh look into the Hillary Clinton email matter. The FBI has launched a new investigation into the Clinton Foundation the day after Clinton's Chappaqua property caught fire. Former FBI Director James Comey's full Clinton memo was released, revealing felony evidence of changes which decriminalized Hillary Clinton's behavior. Oh, and every one of the memos that Comey leaked to his Cornell professor buddy was classified per a sworn statement by the FBI's Chief Freedom of Information Act officer in a sworn declaration obtained by Judicial Watch. The House Intelligence Committee will be granted access to all the remaining investigative documents that are unredacted, along with all the witnesses, as per a deal that was reached between Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and Devin Nunes, who's co-chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Opposition research firm Fusion GPS, the people behind this dossier, the Fusion dossier, were forced to hand over their banking records. And this is going to be significant because it's going to detail various clients and their intermediary law firms, including the Clinton campaign and a Russian money launderer whose lawyer was none other than the Natalia Veselnitskaya of the Trump Tower meeting frame. Most of these wheels, which appear to be in motion, are the result of corresponding groundwork laid on Capitol Hill that you might not be aware of, including what might be the most important document in the entire process. It's coming out in a little less than a week. On January 15th, the Department of Justice's internal watchdog, the Office of the Inspector General, is expected to present their findings to congressional investigators regarding a wide variety of alleged bias and malfeasance by the FBI, the Clinton campaign, and the Obama administration, both during and after the 2016 election. Moreover, the man heading up the Office of the Inspector General's investigation, Michael Horowitz, fought for the Obama administration, fought the Obama administration to regain the investigative powers which were restricted by former Attorney General Eric Holder during the Fast and Furious scandal. If you guys remember, when that broke loose in 2011, Holder and the Oval Office went to great lengths to marginalize the effectiveness of the Inspector General's office. Well, one of the men who was there at that time and who survived it is Michael Horowitz. Now, what's going to happen is the report that is coming due this coming week from the Office of the Inspector General is most likely going to be the legal impetus behind another special counsel, as detailed by an independent researcher from New York. His reporting, a guy named Trump Soldier, who is in the know on this, his reporting is a deep dig into the ongoing investigation by the Inspector General and how Congress and the OIG have worked in tandem to pave the way for a special counsel, and how Michael Horowitz went to war with the Obama administration to restore the Office of the Inspector General's power. Now, Horowitz was appointed head of the Office of Inspector General in April 2012, just after the Obama administration had hobbled the Inspector General's investigative powers in 2011 during the Fast and Furious scandal. The changes forced the various inspectors general for all government agencies to request information while conducting investigations, as opposed to the authority to demand it. This allowed Eric Holder and other agencies' heads to bog down the Office of Inspector General requests in bureaucratic red tape, and in some cases, simply just deny them outright. Back in March of 2015, Horowitz's office prepared a report for Congress titled Open and Unimplemented Inspector General Recommendations. It laid the Obama administration bare before Congress. It illustrated, among other things, how the administration was wasting tens of billions of dollars simply by ignoring the recommendations of the Office of Inspector General. These are the guys that keep the government slim and trim, or at least try to, and to get rid of wasteful spending. Now, after several attempts by Congress to restore the OIG's investigative powers, Representative Jason Chaffetz successfully introduced House Rule 6450, the Inspector General Empowerment Act of 2016, signed by a defeated lame duck President Obama into law on December 16, 2016. And this cemented an alliance between Horowitz and both houses of Congress. Now, because of this Inspector General Empowerment Act of 2016, the office has access to all the information that the target agency possesses. This not only includes their internal documentation and data, but also that which the agency externally collected and documented. In his efforts to roll back Eric Holder's restrictions on the Office of Inspector General's, Horowitz sealed the working relationship between Congress and the IG's office, and they most certainly both appear to be on the same page. Moreover, new FBI Director Christopher Wray seems to be on the same page as well. Now, let's take these things. If there is another independent counsel, another special counsel that is appointed to look into these things, that special counsel is going to be a guy who will be able to operate within the framework and the authority of the Inspector General's office, and they will be able to get the information they need. These agencies will no longer be able to stonewall and blow smoke and obfuscate what's been going on with the Clinton campaign and its collusion with, there's the Russian collusion, but its collusion with GPS Fusion and all the internal shenanigans between the Clinton campaign and the Democrat National Committee during the election to rig this thing so that Hillary could get the nomination, freezing Bernie Sanders out. And that's exactly what they did. The emails revealed that. So, with this new law in place, Michael Horowitz on January 12th of last year announced an Office of Inspector General's investigation based on requests from numerous chairmen and ranking members of congressional oversight committees. and various organizations, for example, Judicial Watch, perhaps, and members of the public. The initial focus ranged from the FBI's handling of the Clinton email investigation to whether or not FBI Director, Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe should have been recused from the investigation, ostensibly over $700,000 his wife's campaign took from Clinton crony Terry McAuliffe, who was at that time governor of Virginia, to potential collusion with the Clinton campaign and the timing of various Freedom of Information Act releases. Questions range from Loretta Lynch. Well, gosh, I lost my place. Okay. Questions range from Loretta Lynch directing Mr. Comey to mislead the American people on the nature of the Clinton investigation, Secretary Clinton's mishandling of classified information, and the mishandling of her email investigation by the FBI. In addition to that, they're also going to be looking at the Department of Justice's failure to impanel a grand jury to investigate Clinton and questions about the Clinton Foundation, Uranium One, and whether the FBI relied on the Trump-Russia dossier created by Fusion GPS. There are a number of documents that have been made available now, or in this last year, to the Inspector General. So what's happening is that these wheels are grinding, and I'm going to wrap this up quickly, but they're grinding slowly. So if we take what we see here with this report that's going to be coming out next week, that may or may not, sometimes there's a lot of hype built up into these things, and we think, oh, my God, this is it. They're finally going to get them, and then nothing happens, or it's, you know, papers are shuffled and people stare fixedly off into space. But it's entirely possible that with the investigations and the interviewing of witnesses that's going on out in Little Rock, Arkansas, where the FBI is on the ground and they are actively interviewing people and investigating, that's where we need to be paying attention. You need to be looking at the investigation as it pertains to Little Rock and impaneling a grand jury in the state of Arkansas. And I'm not exactly sure that there's a whole lot of love lost between the people of Arkansas and Bill Clinton. Actually, I don't think there's a whole lot of love between the Clintons and Arkansas at all. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. Well, we're down to the last couple of minutes, and as I said, this was something I had wanted to do to make up for trying to. Thank you. 90 seconds left. Try to atone for the screw up I made on Thursday. I want to thank you for listening. We will have the Tuesday and Thursday shows next week, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The American Brand Radio Initiative with myself and our good friend Scott Kesterson will be live on the Patriot Nation Radio Network, Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. The recorded version of the of this program is called A Conservative's Perspective. It will be available at the Talk America Radio Network. You can find that at talkamericaradio.org, along with a whole host of other outstanding programs and talk radio heroes. Thank you guys once again. We'll see you Tuesday. I'm James Bostic for the American Brand Radio Initiative. Good night. God bless you all. God bless America.